all of the relationships that emerge in the formation of the family that fills the earth is to fill the earth. And within that human family, you have, I guess maybe you say it's a subset, but it's the marriage is the source of the family at large, individual families, and then the whole human family. But if I think of myself, I'm still trying to get my thoughts around this, but as a husband and father, I have relationships to my wife and my children and grandchildren. But I have more relationships with people outside of my family narrowly. And that's the family, the larger family. And we all have that. And it's like, this is where it's going. The design was to have family, a family to fill the earth. So I'm not sure which way to use subset. Maybe Danny with his engineering mind would go with you more on that. But it's something like that. There's a way in which there, we talk about it, family as like the family unit as the bedrock of a society and that type of thing. And I'm not trying to dispute that. But there's a sense in which it has a subservient role in the production of the family, the larger family. And we'll try to see that a little bit more.
It's an integral part, though, isn't it?
Yeah, of course,
It's not just subservient.
Well, yeah, I don't want to sound like I'm belittling the place of the family too much. I'm just trying to... This whole effort here today is to try to get some kind of huge perspective on the family. And so this is one way. And I'm trying to find the right words, but it does seem that the code reveals something beyond the individual family to the nation, the holy people as a family, and the relationships then that are to exist in family love across throughout the entire nation, which is what the human race ought to be, and this anticipates the coming of the church from the old Israel to the new.
Yeah.
But I mean, some thoughts? Go ahead.
Could you say then that intimacy is sort of the beginning of the family, but it doesn't define the family in terms of its... It's love. It shouldn't be defining the family.
Right.
Even though it's the source of...
Yes. Somehow, that's what I'm trying to say. You'll see. That'll come out even more as we keep going here. And that's it's something like that. I think that in our this oversexed emphasis of our society, it's missing what the human family is. Yeah. And the relationships that we're all to have with one another. I see a great sin against family and pornography and all of the different sins that are, not just against marriage, marriage is a sin against against marriage, what God has ordained for marriage, but also for family, that emerges from marriage.
Yeah.
And it's a larger extended family of the human family. Let's see if what I'm kind of driving at in a broad way comes out a little bit more as we look at the church and then consummation. But through restoration, the new Israel is also to be a holy family. Like you could see how sometimes these dovetail, like what I was working with in the sermon today a little bit, and the importance that Jesus places on that with how we treat other family members, But the New Testament grounds Christian conduct in the Leviticus call to holiness. Look at this as the most precise verse of all of them, but in 1 Peter 1:13-16. Therefore, preparing your minds for action and being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that would be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Note this phrase here. As obedient children, talking to all these people in the church, right? Peter and all the exiles or wherever he's speaking to. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written in the Leviticus code, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which war against your soul. Love the brotherhood. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly. Now, just to comment on it a little bit, the passions of the flesh, 1 Peter 2:11, and our former ignorance, 1:14, contradict the holiness God requires in Leviticus 18 through 20. Now, notice here, I'm going to quote from 20, verses 7 to 16. Let me read that because we didn't look at 20. 20 repeats a lot of what we saw in 18 and adds the death penalty. So and it's from 20 that Peter quotes when he quotes the phrase about be holy as I am holy. So here we have 20 verse beginning at, I think it's verse 2. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Well, that's 19, 2 to 3. And then we have, consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. Now in chapter 20, keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. For anyone who curses his father and mother shall surely be put to death. If a man commits adultery, death. If a man lies with his father's wife, death. If a man lies with his daughter-in-law, death. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, death. If a man lies with an animal, death. If a woman approaches any animal and lies with it, death. You can read in between all the things I left out. But now, notably, all fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, men, women, etc., are children in God's new Israelite family, the church, called to be a holy people, a holy nation, 1 Peter 2:9. They are not to be conformed to the passions of the flesh that contradict holiness defined in Leviticus 18 to 20 per the quote in 1:16. Homosexuality, Leviticus 18:22, also in chapter 20, I think verse 13, is therefore not only a sin against God's standard for marriage, but it is also a sin against God's standard for love in the human family generally, and in the restored family of God, the church specifically. Other New Testament passages contain the same idea. Now see, you see how I read Peter's hook into the Leviticus code? You know, when people are saying, well, you know, what are the homosexuality texts? They usually are looking at the texts that are explicitly use the term. And I've said earlier in another context that there's a much broader way to approach this, and it's included under all sexual sins. Well, here is one way you can see the linking in. We're to be holy, like defined, Peter even specifies sexual purity in the church is to make us a holy nation. We are to be a holy nation regarding sexual purity in the church as defined by the Holiness Code, which includes homosexuality as a sin, and these other things that are listed. Should I go to Ephesians and Thessalonians before we comment on this? Let me just go to those two that aren't as the same, but I mean, I think they're the same because of the holy people phrases. It's not quite the same kind of quoting of the Holiness Code like Peter does. Ephesians, here's my idea. As love children, you walk in love by sexual purity as the new holy people of Leviticus. So here, be imitators of God. In other words, be holy as God is holy. Therefore, dearly beloved, as dearly loved children, the family of brothers and sisters again, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But among you, there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality, or of any kind of impurity, language that would be reflect on the way immorality, sexual immorality is spoken of in Leviticus, as well as the other these other images here, because these are improper for God's holy people, like the holy, you know, that we are now the new Israel, like the holy people of Israel were to be in the Old Testament. Thus, for the tie with Leviticus, God's holy and pure people, homosexuality is contrary to sexual purity, and more deeply, it is contrary to family law. And then one more, Thessalonians, on this still this point about through restoration in the new Israel. Here's the idea. You please God as a Leviticus-like holy family by sexual purity. Finally then, brothers, we ask and urge you in the Lord Jesus that as you have received from us how you ought to walk and to please God, for this is the will of God, your sanctification being made holy, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you know how to control his own body in holiness and honor, and not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, that no one transgress and wrong his brother or sister in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger in all these things, as we told you before and solemnly warned you, for God has not called us for impurity, but in holiness, as Leviticus defines holiness in contrast to sexual immorality and impurity. Therefore, whoever disregards this disregards not man, but God, who gives his Holy Spirit to you. So there's just three texts from the New Testament. You can probably find others. These seem to be very paramount and dealing with, explicitly dealing with, but in a more general way, sexual immorality in the life of the church. And its roots, just like the Corinthian passage about incest, Paul doesn't have to go through all of that again. It's there in Leviticus. But so he can reference these things, and then we know the details. You can read Leviticus 18. It's part of God's holy word for profit, for instruction for today. So any thoughts on this one? This is just trying to see the New Testament family against the same backdrop. But, yes, John?
For me, I guess I'm sort of seeing the simplicity of it here, that it's not just about your own purity. It's because if you engage in behavior with another person, it's they're sinning as well, causing them to sin.
Yes.
It just shows the mutuality of it. How it's not just a personal thing where you have to kind of control it on your own, but it's just that family, I guess.
Yes.
Simplicity of that argument.
Sure.
It's kind of, I don't know, sticking with me a little bit.
Yeah. I think there's a certain, I know it's helped me, this research on this, to see the church, the community, the larger picture of the church this way, not just as individuals who struggle, individual struggles with things, you know. But we, in the family of God, we're children under one Father, we're brothers and sisters, and the maintenance of purity involves sexual purity, and it's a community-wide issue, and it's rooted in what Israel, you know. It's the whole idea, like, to, you know, like people are saying, well, how can you draw from the holiness code? And, you know, I mean, we have to just see this larger picture of the old Israel, the new Israel, and how this is a matter of what the human race is supposed to be from Adam and Eve, but the fall has intruded. Israel was the model for, you know, part of restoration, and now into the life of the church, the family that fills the earth, a pure family, you know. So then now let's think of glory. Let's take it one step further into consummation. in the consummation, heaven will be a place of holy family love without marriage. The church of sexual purity in all relationships, men to men, women to women, men to women, that emerge from marital intimacy, in other words, family, is to be a foretaste, anticipation, and embodiment of the glory to come, where sexual intimacy will have passed away in ultimate fulfillment. Now, if we cultivate brotherly and sisterly love that respects the boundaries of marriage, which is, you know, like in all of the places and all the relationships that are outside of those boundaries, right? That is, that are, you know, in the family that has emerged from marriage. If we respect it there and cultivate it there, then we anticipate the glory of heaven where there will be no marrying or giving in marriage. We then have a goal for the present rooted in what is coming. Here, just to quote Edwards, an inconceivably pure, sweet, and fervent love between the saints in glory. Because heaven is a world of love, where this glorious fountain forever flows forth in streams, yea, in rivers of love and delight, and these rivers swell, as it were, to an ocean of love, in which the souls of the ransomed may bathe with the sweetest enjoyment, and their hearts, as it were, be deluged with love. Thus, being bound for perfect holiness that has no sexual overtones, we are called to holiness in all relationships that emerge from the blessing of sexual intimacy here on earth. Love between women is exemplified in the love between Ruth and Naomi. Love between men ought to grow in this life toward the love shared, for example, between Jonathan and David. Listen to this. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house, took David, that is, to become his instrument player in his cabinet or whatever. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt, 1 Samuel 18, 1-4. Growth is the operative word, granting that men are often too reserved, too proud, too emotionally fragile, fearing rejection, to develop close, affectional bonds with other men. Now, I almost hate to have that next paragraph in here, but we've got to deal with our topic and the broad way that we're attacking it. But this is a great picture, I think, of family love and the love between men like Jonathan and David. But let's listen to what this defender of gay exegesis does here. In the context of this study, Helminiak suggests that David and Jonathan had a homosexual relationship. To 18:1-4, which I just read, he adds 1 Samuel 20:30. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen, loved the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" Now he picks up with his grid. Hear the language of that, and if you think of what he just said, this is. So now I'm going to just respond to him, Helminiak, immediately here. Regarding 20:30, the verse that we just read, Helminiak misses the clear point that for Saul, Jonathan shames himself and his mother by giving up his claim to be the next king. In Saul's view, Jonathan dishonors his mother who conceived him to the shame of her nakedness. That is, that's, you know, just it's a, the euphemism for their knowing that brought conception and birth to this man, Jonathan, to be the next king. And he dishonors himself as a rightful heir. it's to your shame, by forfeiting his title to David. Therefore, Helmaniac, driven by an erotocentric mindset, it's the only way I can figure out what he's doing. It's that grid that he has. Also misses the loving self-sacrifice of Jonathan Per 18:1-4. He misses the example of a man loving another man as he loves himself, as the great love command teaches. This is just basic. Love God with all your strength and your neighbor as yourself. Jonathan exemplified that with regard to David. Now, you know, taking off his robe and his, what else, armor and his sword and his bow and his belt, what is that? He turned all these things over to David. You're going to be the king, not me. And he had, and he did it self-sacrificing, in sacrifice of all his own thoughts that he would become the king, the next king. Any thoughts on this? I'll just stop there for a minute, because it's almost like a, you know, after dealing, we quote Edwards about charity and its fruits and love as a place of, heaven as a place of love. And then we, I just felt, I feel like expose us all to some of the thoughts that are done by some of these thinkers. There are more details that aren't worthy of attention from his work around this section here. He does try to deal with the Hebrew and the LXX and things like that, but I think the only way I'll tell you, without getting into things that are, I guess it'd just be too difficult to state publicly, but the phrase I use, that he's working with an erotocentric mindset, that's the only way I can understand what he does with some of these texts. It's like a person with a dirty mind. And you hear a certain phrase, it has double meaning. And we would normally just use it just the regular way, you know. I have this all the time at tennis. I won't go into some of the things, but different things. I have to be careful what I say, because there's all kinds of meanings attached to these words that have sexual innuendos to them that people pick up on. And they just, they ruin conversation because they have dirty minds, and I don't want to go there with them. That's what I mean by this erotocentric mindset. Anyway, any thoughts up to that point? I want to get back to our looking ahead to glory, but any other thoughts on any of this? Glad to.
It's hard to you know, wrap my hands around sexual intimacy, and knowing that it will not exist in the hereafter. You know, it's like mm-hmm. I can't think of any other case where there's a disconnect between the now and the not yet, like that. You know,
like that.
Usually we have a taste now,
yeah.
You know, taint of its sin, but
yeah,
it's a real taste of what was to come. I'm not quite sure how to deal with that disconnect. You know, because it's a big deal about sexual intimacy. It's not trivial,
right?
You know, it's to be done here. It's
made
it pleasurable.
Think in a negative way about what God has ordained for this earth. But this is an important perspective. Let me read the rest and then come back with some of your thoughts, because that's what I want to pick up on. Sure. Looking again to glory, the fact that marriage discontinues is evidence that in male-to-female relationships, sexuality, desire for an engagement in sex, is not central, necessary, or essential to being human and bearing God's image. It is the voice of sexual desire run amok that speaks when sexual pleasure is viewed as the core of being human and the key to the biblical texts about human love. The core in marriage is the covenant of companionship in knowing each other, in knowing God. That is the spillover to all relationships of holy people in companionship and fellowship with the triune God. Now, the precious bond that we cultivate in the Christian church family is a wholesome, deep, affectional, and emotional bond of brother to brother and sister to brother and brother to sister that is not sex drive driven. By this love, we anticipate the love that abides in heaven. The eschatological perspective shows that though a source of wonderful delight, sexuality is not ultimate. Full humanness will be attained in glory without it. This outlook helps us maintain a balanced view of the great delight of marital intimacy by checking exaggeration and preserving holiness. These insights help us put to death, or put sin to death in our members by putting love, marriage, and marital intimacy into a rich biblical perspective. So, let's go ahead with your question, and let's start where it's at.
So here's a question for you. Tell me, how is it then that the like a Roman Catholic priest isn't onto something when they vow a life of celibacy in the service of God?
Well, one, there may be some who are eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. Some may do that, but the part of the problem with Rome on their structure is it's required of all priests. Mm-hmm. Like they think the Bible requires it and it doesn't. But there, Jesus does teach that there may be people who are made eunuchs by men, slaves, and there are those who may have a gift of celibacy who are eunuchs for the kingdom of God's sake. So even in this earth, they do not have sexual intimacy and they serve the Lord. They never marry.
Like Paul.
Well, one could argue that maybe they go about it in a less than perfect way. Yeah, but the minimizing of sex, you know, that there's something noble to that goal.
I don't think this eschatological perspective minimizes it. What they do is they actually, my understanding of Roman Catholic view of sexuality is that it is in itself somehow tainted. And that's why you have to have that for a priest, because even in marriage, there's a taintedness about sexual intimacy. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong, there's something carnal bad about it. Mm-hmm. That's part of their theology, if I'm correct, and I'll stand, you know, to fuller research on this, and that's been my understanding, you know, and so there's a problem of not seeing it correctly in the now. Now, but I think that if we have an eschatological perspective, first we see, go all the way across history, we see the way family emerges from marital intimacy. And that family is what's to fill the earth, and family is what's going to be in glory, and there will be no marrying or giving in marriage. That for us, what does it mean to be male and female image bearers? You can attain that to its fullest and glorified state without sexual intimacy. So it helps us put sexual intimacy into a proper perspective and not exaggerate its place. Exaggeration is exactly what happens in our oversexed society, you know. And I think this is a part of, I think, our weaponry in understanding ourselves, not say, this is how I identify myself. As a sexual being and as having this sexual drive, that's the key to my identity. It's not the key to my identity. I'm not trying to say it's not a component part of our mind and everyone's identity, but it's not the key to our identity. And that's why, even in marriage, that's why I like to say, this supports what I've done in the past about sexual intimacy is the 5% part and the 95% part of the covenant of companionship. The sexual intimacy in marriage is the 5% part of the covenant of companionship. It's very meaningful and it's very valuable, but, you know, this is using a quantitative thing, but what is it a symbol of? It's a symbol of the knowing of one another in knowing God between two people, that relates even then extends out to the family of our walk with God. It's people knowing God and knowing one another as people who know God. And so even in marriage, I just really do feel that the most important thing is the relationship that husband and wife sustain to one another in their covenant with the Lord in the triangle. Remember when we talk about it in the covenant of marriage, you covenant with each other, and each covenants with the Lord, and what gives marriage its fullness and its richness is that relationship with God and coming to know each other. So sexual intimacy is a part of that. We're not trying, and we're saying it's a vital part, but it's like symbolic, and it has something else to which it directs our thoughts and takes us on, you know, in a fuller way. Go ahead, John, and then
so
come back.
Our maleness and femaleness doesn't pass away in heaven.
I don't know how I would say that.
Intimacy
yeah.
passes.
Yeah.
You're saying intimacy passes
yeah.
away, but there's, I mean, God made
male and female.
Male
yeah.
and female before the fall.
Right.
And we're continue to be male and female. And
I would think, I don't know what else to say to that except yes. And then.
So there's more to it than just intimacy, obviously. Right?
Yeah.
Because the family is
yeah.
a family of males and females.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because all through the family, in the human family, we have fathers to fathers and mothers to mothers, or brothers to sisters, sister to brother, you know. And there's the basic polarity of the human family is male and female. And I don't, you know, we don't have a lot about heaven and about what this all involves, but I think we get a perspective, and it helps us to see things. Perspective has that. I think that's part of our weaponry as people. Perspective is part of what will help us put our emphasis in the proper places and have our priorities right, and thus have the best kind of intimacy in marriage and in life in general, where people are. Celibate or maintain purity. You know, this is we have the best then of it all. I think this way. You know.
In the CRC, with their feminist movement back 25 years ago, they were using this marriage thing as a protological view and then an eschatological view, and they would say protologically we were given in marriage, you know, but eschatologically, it's not going to be given in marriage. So we should adapt this eschatological view for today. So their view was Galatians 3:28.
No male or female?
No man, no woman, no man, bond nor free, nor yeah. Jew nor Gentile, etc., yeah. etc. Et you know?
Yeah. And well, it, I
and
just
that,
wonder...
That just that, blew me away.
Yeah, well, it, I just wonder what... You know, it sounds like a reductio ad absurdum here.
That
argument,
right.
Well, that argument, it sounds to me, the way the argument's phrased, it means you have no marriage here now. No marriage.
Or, I mean, or you can marry Bruce. I can marry
yeah, well, I know, but I mean, I'm going beyond that. That there would be even, on that argument, it's
yeah.
not just that you could justify marriage between male
right.
and male or something. That argument would be you don't have marriage at all.
Right.
Nowhere in the present. So I don't know where that... I'd have to read that whole argument because it sounds like there's a certain obvious absurdity to which the line of argument leads, which shows that it, in its beginning, is a lot of mistakes in the argument.
In my own inimitable way, I said to them on this committee, I was on the committee, and I said, so then me and Bob can get married. Oh, that is so ridiculous.
They just want to do it. Well, I gather what you're
more
saying.
Ridiculous.
I think they were trying to apply it to headship and to a headship and limit ourselves to equality. They wanted to try to make
it egalitarianism.
Egalitarianism and ordination of women in the church and things
sure.
like that would be what they're trying to do. But see, you got to be careful when you argue like that because. Your form of your argument has certain implications in it. If they lead you into these absurdities, there's something wrong with that argument.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's what they're doing there.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not doing that here. I mean, it seems to me that this
no.
is moving this is moving from old Israel to new Israel, to, well, you know, and all the way back to the from the garden ultimately. But because of the fall, we have old Israel, new Israel, and glory.
Right.
And we get to glory, we're heading where Adam and Eve were supposed to take us before the fall. They would fill the earth right. with a pure family.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that. So now, I don't. I think we have a. This is just a perspective. We got to absorb this. I'm not. I'm trying to. As I've been reading, I have gotten this. These authors who try to say they want to make our desire for sex.
Tantamount.
Yeah, that's it. That's the word. I mean, I know that it's a vital part of our. You know, it's a part of our makeup. And I'm not sure how to pin this down, but if it's not ultimate, if we can be the image of God in glory as male and female without sexual intimacy, then there's something wrong with trying to make that the most important part of my existence. We've got to come at it from another angle. So something's wrong. Something's broke here. You know, we got to.
Ultimate, they want to make it penultimate.
The ultimate man, Jesus Christ, was never married nor sexually intimate.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to be made, and we're being conformed to him. Now, I mean, I know you can think, you know, if you think of male, female, you know, issues, but. He is set out in front of us as we are being conformed to his image. And so I think you're just, this is complementing the point I'm making. That is the ultimate goal.
And then Christ's own illustration is we are his bride. You know, and we mm-hmm. are, the church is going to be his bride
yeah.
in the marriage, Lamb of the Feast.
Yeah. So the only way we have marriage in heaven is that marriage.
Yes.
That's the marriage, and that's the feast. That's back to these other themes we've been looking at in Luke. John, another comment with that?
Yeah, I mean, is intimacy also kind of a shadow form of in glory? The fact that we're completely exposed. You know, I mean, all of our sin throughout our life, everything is completely exposed, but we're not ashamed.
Yeah.
And because Christ has covered us with his
yeah.
righteousness.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the kind of intimacy
yes.
where you can be completely exposed and not ashamed.
Yes, that's a great point. That's a great point, and I think that's where we can now tap in some more to, which I didn't do here, but this is filling this out a bit better. They're using, seeing intimacy, it has this, it does have a shadow to reality. There's an intimacy in glory, and there are ways that we can isolate that out of intimacy from marriage, like that, like being exposed to one another and not being ashamed, and the knowing, the intimate knowledge of one another, knowing one another. These are things that would, this is how, when you really get to know someone, just a good friend in life, you know them. It's an intimate coming to know them in thought, and that's what we should be developing. Well, that's what glory will be. So, and there are these, and there are these aspects in which the family unit, the head of the family, the mother and father, should spill over in teaching that to the children and the family, and then it should spread out through the extended family and fill the earth. Well, we will fill. It'll be in glory since the fall, because of the fall. That's a good point. Though. That's good. I didn't pick up on that.
Eurocentric, or whatever the word you use there, is a very individualistic, self-centered aspect of that.
That's an interesting point. I haven't seen the community, the communal ideas coming out in any of this literature yet. Maybe it's there. I don't know if any of you've read anything that. Picks up on it, but I do hear a more individualistic, you know, flavor. That's why I found this very strikingly. This whole thing of these two pages, to me, it's like, this is like just this big, huge sailboat out in the fresh air, just sailing out into the sea. You know, it's so different than what I've been reading in the literature.
You mean like it's autonomy driven? You know, it's just their.
No, no, I'm saying I think this is good. I was trying to say that this is the. Oh. I'm trying to bad illustration maybe, but I'm. Okay. I just say this is fresh air. This is so different than what I'm reading in the autonomy driven, and that I haven't picked up on a communal.
Familial.
The whole family that emerges from the narrower family and from the husband and wife, and that there's something, this is the greater picture, family love, and family love is being violated when we have this erotocentric mindset.
See, I always thought that, that mindset that it exists outside of marriage, and it exists inside of marriage, and that it's when you have those thoughts outside of marriage that you've crossed God's lines here, but inside of marriage that a man and a woman should feel free to, you know, be sexual with each other.
Yeah,
and
but
have comfort about that. You know?
Of course, but it can be abused, just like the. I think, like the menstrual selfishness of men and things like that, it can be exaggerated. Well, that's where adultery comes from, for one to say. You know, it's exaggerated within the marriage, out of proportion. One is not seeing themselves properly, and then not seeing against the image of God, and thus the growing in the knowledge of God as sexual intimacy in marriage as a symbol, not an end in itself, you know, but a symbol of something. Of course, all that God tells us about the delights and the Song of Solomon about it and everything are uplifted, but it can be taken out of proportion and seen wrongly within marriage too. And that winds up with things that wind up breaking marriages or making them less than what they should be in their wholeness of the covenant of companionship. We'll say it like that, you know. But the perspective. This is just, it raises questions, it raises perspectives. So anything else? But all right, well, I want to leave the code. It's been a very fruitful study, I believe. And I think my plan is to look at the major text of First Romans 1 on the topic next time.